Support for the New Hampshire News Recap comes from you, our listeners, and from CASA of New Hampshire, seeking volunteer advocates for children and youth who have experienced abuse and neglect, helping make a difference for local children. New training options start soon. A child's road to safety starts here. Learn more at casanh.org.
This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. A newly released report from the New Hampshire Attorney General's Office finds no evidence of abuse or use of illegal restraints at the state's youth detention center. However, that same report does say that poor leadership, staff shortages, and insufficient training have created serious safety issues, and the shortcomings are putting staff and youth at serious risk. NHPR's Emery Timmons has been reporting on issues surrounding the youth detention center and has been digging into the findings of this new report, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Anne-Marie, first of all, remind us about the allegations at the heart of this investigation by the AG's office.
There are really two primary concerns raised back in March by the Disability Rights Center and then the child advocate for the state. They said staff were using illegal restraints, namely by holding children in prone restraints for too long. And the facility had been in this weeks-long lockdown where the youth were kind of confined to their rooms and then their units and couldn't go to the cafeteria, their gym, to their classroom, and were really being isolated. So those were the two primary things we heard, and that was back in March.
And the report doesn't find evidence to support abuse allegations. So what has been the reaction?
Well, the Department of Health and Human Services, which runs this facility, had disputed the allegations all along. And so, as you would imagine, they welcomed this report. They called it thorough, helpful. The governor did as well. On the other side of that, the Disability Rights Center and the Child Advocates Office said, "We were never contacted by investigators, yet our concerns triggered this inquiry, and our concerns were based on our own interviews with youth and staff and our time in the facility." So they're frustrated by the report, and their own investigations are underway still.
Did the AG's office say why they did not interview those who were making the accusations?
No, they didn't acknowledge the absence of those two parties in the report. And when I followed up with them, they just said, "We're not going to comment beyond what is in the report."
Now, the AG's office is saying that the center has been plagued for years by, quote, chronic dysfunction, ineffective leadership, staff shortages, and poor training, and that those shortcomings are putting staff and youth at serious risk. How so?
Well, I think this report is the first time we've really seen inside the facility how it's run, how youth are responded to, just sort of what the day-to-day is like. And I think that's one of the most interesting pieces of it. So a couple things really stood out. One is that there's this divide between the staff. Some feel that we need to respond to these assaults and incidences of vandalism by enforcing the rules. And then the other side feels that these are actions based out of a trauma background and it needs to be a treatment approach. For example, clinicians who know these kids well are not responding when these codes are called for an emergency. And so the AG's office said that really needs to be a unified single vision. And the second piece were just the staff shortages and the shortage of experienced staff. They said that's a huge problem because there's too few staff managing these housing units. And just as an example, on May 3rd, the report includes a description of these series of incidences that left five staff members injured over the course of the night. People aren't seen until 2 a.m. because there were too few experienced staff to manage the children on the units and no one to respond in the time of emergency.
Anne-Marie, how much does the state's ongoing efforts to deal with the thousands of cases pending in the settlement fund for those who were abused in decades past play into all of this?
It is playing a role, and this surprised me. The report said staff were very much aware of all the lawsuits that are underway for past abuse at the facility, you know, decades ago. But they're on their mind now because they're afraid that if they enforce the rules, they will be accused of assaulting youth. And staff said youth have said to them, "We purposely put ourselves in these prone restraints for an extended period because we are trying to develop, you know, evidence for a lawsuit." And so that is on the mind of staff.
So what does this report say about that violent behavior by youth in the facility?
You know, it really makes clear that staff are suffering very serious assaults. A staff member was out with a brain injury for several weeks. Another staff member had their jaw broken in two places. There was a broken nose. And right now, of the 8 administrators in the Sununu Center, 7 are out with injuries. Also, a youth broke a bone in his hand punching a wall during a crisis. And the report, however, said staff remain very committed to creating a safe, supportive environment for these youth because they know that they're there because they've had such a traumatic childhood.
This sounds like such a hard situation, Anne-Marie. I mean, what happens now?
Well, I think that's really going to depend on what we see in the next state budget. The AG's office called for a number of changes. They said staff should be wearing body-worn cameras. There needs to be more training. There needs to be more staff in general. And the Department of Health and Human Services really welcomed these recommendations and said, we are happy to implement them ASAP, but we need money to do it. You can't keep cutting our budget. They said over the last years, they've seen less and less money for the Division of Youth and Children and Families, and that's trickling down here to what we're seeing at the Sununu Center. Meanwhile, lawmakers have proposed withholding money if the department doesn't put changes in place. And so I think you could see how we could be set up for sort of a catch-22 next year.
Anne-Marie Timmons, Senior Reporter for Youth and Education for NHPR. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
This is Morning Edition from NHPR. We're recapping some of the week's news. What questions do you have about what's going on in the state? You can always email us at voices@nhpr.org. Joining us now is NHPR's Todd Bookman. Todd recently broke a story on how the New Hampshire judicial branch quietly hired a well-connected political operative for some communications work at a cost of $10,000 per month. Thanks for being here, Todd.
Thank you, Rick.
So let's rewind to last October. The Supreme Court found itself in the public eye, not for its rulings, but for some other reasons. What was happening there?
There were two things really happening. First, Justice Anna Barbara Hance Marconi, she had been charged criminally. She was accused of trying to curry favor on behalf of her husband, who was under investigation. Hance Marconi had been on administrative leave. She was not hearing cases. And then last October, she enters a plea of no contest in that case, a guilty plea. And then later that same month, NHPR published a story detailing a highly unusual payout. A top state court employee named Diane Martin, she had been laid off and rehired 48 hours later into a different job at the courts. Because she technically left and then came back, she was able to cash in about $50,000 in unused sick and vacation time. A whistleblower raised concerns about this, accused Chief Justice Gordon McDonald of orchestrating the entire personnel maneuver. And so both of these things are kind of in the news last October, and this is a branch of government that otherwise really only draws attention, you know, when it issues a major ruling. This was not a normal chain of events.
Yeah, so the court is getting some unwanted attention, and it does what, you know, a lot of entities do at these moments. They hire a PR guy.
Yeah. Just a few days after NHPR publishes the Diane Martin story, the courts secretly hire a guy named Pericles Carudis. Carudis is not exactly a household name, but he is well-known and well-connected statehouse insider, lobbyist. I'll give you a quick list of his lobbying clients, Rick. The pesticide industry, a pro-cryptocurrency advocacy group, Coos County, the state's camp directors, and Casella, the garbage company. Carudis also does political campaign work, though. He's on the payroll for a number of Republican Senate candidates. And for a while, he managed a PAC that raises and spends money on behalf of Republican Senate candidates. He's now actually the PAC's largest recipient of money, something like $150,000 in the past 18 months. His firm, though, also does other types of services, communications work, helping to shape messages.
His hiring was kept a secret, though, right? I mean, how did you piece it together?
Yeah, so Carudis was brought on through this no-bid process. From the court's perspective, they have said there wasn't really time. A lot of what the court does is typically outside the public's eye when it comes to spending money. Other state agencies, if they were to hire a consultant, spend public money, that's all vetted. The executive council typically votes to approve contracts. The courts largely shield all of those sorts of transactions from public scrutiny. I first heard about Carudis doing work for the courts actually back in March, but the judicial branch refused to confirm that at the time. They refused to turn over any contract. Then last month, a relatively obscure government database that tracks all public spending finally showed the receipts, showed that Carudis had been paid $70,000. And so once we presented that information to the judicial branch, they turned over a copy of the contract.
And what are the terms in that contract?
He's essentially on a $10,000 per month retainer. The contract was supposed to expire in March, so that would have been 5 months of work, but it appears to have been extended. Court's transparency on this has only gone so far. They didn't provide any records about an extension or copies of any invoices.
Well, Todd, do we know what he's actually doing for the courts?
Yeah, so the contract has specific language in it around communications. That is one of his skills. That's what he's been brought in to do. Courts do already have a full-time communications team, that is state employees who are already paid to interact with the media and members of the public. But Curtis is someone with crisis communications training. One of the first things the court did after it brought Curtis on was issue a rare public statement. And this was signed by the justices, and it defended the Diane Martin payout. The statement said it was a collective decision by the courts and that she was laid off because of a restructuring. I'll note that statement was signed by Justice Brian Gould. This seemed a little strange because Gould was only appointed to the court last fall. He wasn't a sitting justice at the time of the Martin payouts. Gould and Curtis have history. They both served as lobbyists for Casella at the same time, and they both have been involved deeply in state GOP party politics.
So you're saying the state already has communications people, but he's been kind of brought on as a communications fix-it guy.
Yeah, you could see it that way. I mean, the court has long had employees who do this job, who communicate with members of the public, who communicate with lawmakers or with reporters, who may go and testify on bills. He was brought on to do something different.
So what's the reaction been?
You know, I heard the word unusual from some people. Former state Supreme Court Justice Chuck Douglas, former House Speaker Donna Sitek, these are both Republicans. You know, they told me that the court's hiring an outsider to do this kind of messaging work was just not something they remembered from the past. Douglas, you know, noted that he didn't really see any problems with the court's hiring someone with such a partisan background, but it does open the judicial branch up to potential criticism. This is the one branch of government that is supposed to be above politics, but it is hiring someone who lives and breathes Republican politics. And so that's a potential concern for the court's reputation moving forward.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you, Rick.
You can find Todd's reporting at nhpr.org, including this story. If you missed part of today's segment, or if you want to catch up on previous weeks, you can find the New Hampshire News Recap wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Rick Ganley, and this is NHPR.